KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. A federal judge frees the Columbia student arrested over his pro-Palestinian activism. The student's lawyer says his free speech fight continues. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. President Biden let California set stricter emission standards and require more electric vehicles. House Republicans want to undo it. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. But is Congress allowed to reverse Environmental Protection Agency waivers? Also, 50 years after the end of the Vietnam War, a reflection on the trauma that remains. It's Thursday, May 1st. On this day in 1840, the United Kingdom decided to charge the same postage no matter how far a letter was going and issued the first adhesive stamps, just one penny. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The U.S. and Ukraine have signed an agreement that gives the U.S. access to Ukraine's vast mineral deposits. It creates a joint investment fund, and revenue from the fund will come from new licenses for critical raw materials and rare earth minerals. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says the U.S. will share revenue from that fund with Ukraine.
This is a total economic partnership. This isn't just rare earths. It's infrastructure, it's energy. There's the opportunity here for both sides to really win.
He spoke with Fox Business. However, the deal does not provide Ukraine with explicit security guarantees from the U.S. The fund can be used to finance new military aid to Ukraine. Harvard University has met a deadline from the Department of Homeland Security. It has handed over information about international students. From member station GBH in Boston, Kirk Carapeza reports the university isn't saying exactly what was shared.
2 weeks ago, the Trump administration demanded detailed records for foreign students' illegal and violent activities. If not, the school would risk losing the ability to enroll international students altogether. In a message to the campus community, Harvard Executive VP Meredith Wienick says the university has responded to that request, but doesn't detail what was turned over. Wienick reiterates Harvard's, quote, steadfast commitment to international students, urging them to stay focused on academics. The Trump administration accuses Harvard of anti-Semitism, setting pro-Palestinian demonstrations. For NPR News, I'm Kirk Carapeza in Boston.
Fewer people identify as Southern Baptists, and fewer churches belong to that denomination. That's according to recent data released by Lifeway Research. Nevertheless, the church says it is encouraged by some of the positive numbers. From member station WPLN in Nashville, Mariana Bacayao has more.
The Southern Baptist Church baptized more people last year than it has in the past seven. Plus, its congregation saw growth in weekly church attendance and participation in small group Bible studies. But congregants are still leaving the nation's largest Protestant mainline denomination as leadership debates the role of women in ministry. New Spring Megachurch in South Carolina left the denomination last month after a Southern Baptist committee questioned the leadership role of one of the church's female staffers. The Southern Baptist Church will soon converge for its annual meeting, where church leadership could take up the issue, along with budget discussions. The denomination saw a nearly $470 million loss last year in church giving. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Bacayao in Nashville.
On Wall Street, stocks are higher. The Dow is up more than 300 points. The Nasdaq is up more than 2%. This is NPR. The CEO of automaker General Motors says President Trump's tariffs will cost that company between $4 and $5 billion this year. Speaking to CNN, Mary Barra said that at this time, GM does not expect to pass higher costs onto consumers. She warned GM will watch the market closely and prices can change every month in the automotive industry. South Korea's acting president has resigned, signaling he may compete in presidential elections in June. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Seoul The elections were triggered by the impeachment of former President Yoon Suk-yeol.
Prime Minister and acting President Han Duck-soo told a press briefing that he had thought hard before resigning without explicitly saying he plans to run for president. But South Korean media report Han is assembling his campaign team before announcing his candidacy on Friday. He's expected to seek the nomination of the conservative ruling People Power Party. Han was appointed prime minister by the impeached ex-president Yoon Suk-yeol. One recent poll showed Han trailing the leading candidate, opposition leader Lee Jae-myung, 13% to 42%. Lee continues to face legal problems. The Supreme Court on Thursday struck down a verdict acquitting him of charges that he violated election laws. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
A truck driving north of Fort Worth, Texas, rolled on its side Tuesday, spilling its cargo on the road. It was a load of 8 million separate dimes. Two people in the truck were not seriously hurt. Texas authorities say they ended up using huge vacuum trucks to suck the dimes up off the road. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Ukraine and the U.S. have agreed to a deal.
They will share profits from the sale of Ukraine's critical minerals and raw materials. Both sides are calling it a win. The deal is intended to give the White House an economic motive to keep investing in Ukraine's defense and reconstruction as the Trump administration tries to broker an end to the war.
Joining us now to tell us more about this is NPR's Joanna Kakissis, who's in Kyiv, Ukraine's capital. Hello, Joanna. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
So how will this economic agreement work?
So Ukraine's economy minister, Yulia Svitidenko, she led Ukrainian negotiations on the deal, and she said income would come from new licenses for critical minerals, things like graphite, titanium, lithium, as well as other natural resources. And she noted that Ukraine and the U.S. will have equal voting rights over the investment fund, and that Ukraine would keep total control of its infrastructure and natural resources. Now, U.S. mining companies are expected to make money, of course, as are other American companies if they end up being involved in Ukraine's reconstruction.
Now, this just all came together just a few hours ago as we are speaking now. But from what you understand, how are Ukrainians reacting to this deal?
Well, the Ukrainians I've spoken to describe, I would describe their reaction as very guarded optimism. We spoke to Volodymyr Londa, a senior economist with the Center for Economic Strategy in Kyiv. He's been following the minerals negotiations closely for months, and he says this deal at least does not smack of colonialism.
The agreement is designed as a win-win partnership, which gives us hope that such an agreement will actually be implemented in the long run.
So unlike previous versions of the deal, Landa says, this version does not obstruct Ukraine on its path to the European Union. And crucially, it appears to not count previous U.S. military aid to Ukraine as debt that needs to be repaid.
Does this mean that the Trump administration's relationship with Ukraine has improved?
Well, you know, some people here are sure hoping so because the relationship wasn't good to begin with. You will recall that in late February, this minerals agreement stalled when Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited the White House and President Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance publicly berated him for not being grateful enough for U.S. support. Zelensky had refused to sign an early draft of the minerals deal because he said it would have left generations of Ukrainians deeply in debt while giving them very little in return, especially security guarantees so Russia does not invade Ukraine again.
And does this deal address any of those security guarantees?
So, Michelle, from what we know, it does not address them explicitly, though Ukrainians see the language coming out of the White House as a good sign. For example, in a statement, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said that the agreement shows Russia that this administration wants a free, sovereign, and prosperous Ukraine. And he added, quote, no state or person who financed or supplied the Russian war machine will be allowed to benefit from the reconstruction of Ukraine. Now, Ukraine says these security guarantees are crucial, especially as ceasefire talks continue. Meanwhile, Russia has unilaterally declared its own three-day ceasefire starting in a week to mark the Soviet Union's victory against Nazi Germany. But the Russians say they're in no hurry to come to the negotiating table.
That is NPR's Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. Joanna, thank you.
You're welcome.
Columbia University student Mohsen Mahdawi, a lawful permanent resident detained over his pro-Palestinian activism, is free. A federal judge in Vermont released him yesterday with conditions as his case continues. Outside the court, Mahdawi was greeted by a crowd of supporters.
I am saying it clear and loud.
Yes.
To President Trump and his cabinet.
Yes.
I am not afraid of you.
Yes! He is one of multiple international students involved in advocacy to end the war in Gaza who've been detained and are at risk of deportation under the Trump administration. In his opinion, the judge, Jeffrey W. Crawford, wrote, quote, legal residents not charged with crimes or misconduct are being arrested and threatened with deportation for stating their views on the political issues of the day. He likened this moment to the Red Scare and McCarthy eras. A Department of Homeland Security spokesperson said in statements to the press that no lawsuit or judge would stop the administration from, quote, restoring the rule of law to our immigration system. Joining me now is one of Mahdawi's lawyers, Luna Drewby. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So, you know, our listeners heard from your client, Mohsen Mahdawi, from prison just a couple days ago, and now he's been released. Were you surprised that it happened?
Of course, I was surprised that it was happened, but it was absolutely the right thing to do. The judge understood that. He heard what Mohsen had to say. He read the law, and he did the right thing.
What did he say to you when he was released?
Mohsen is a very calm presence. And so, you know, he just looked at me and he said, thank you. And he nodded and he gave me a big hug. And that was it. I think he's still processing what happened. But I think I saw a huge sense of relief on his face.
But this case is not over. What were the conditions of his release?
He set only a few conditions. That he remain in Vermont, which is his home anyway, that he be allowed to travel to New York City to attend Columbia, which is his goal anyway, and that, you know, any other travel would have to get approved by the court, and that he has to attend hearings in the case.
What happens next? I know there are two tracks. The federal court case where you've petitioned the court saying that your client's First Amendment right to free speech has been violated and his right to due process has been violated. But there's also an immigration case around his deportation.
The immigration case proceeds. This case has nothing to do with that immigration proceeding. So we proceed. There will be continued litigation in the federal case, which we hope to succeed on as well, to frame this entire engagement in what happened to Mr. Mahdawi as unconstitutional.
Now, the government is invoking this Rarely Used Immigration Act, saying that
Mohsen Mahdawi's presence in the U.S. would have adverse consequences on U.S. foreign policy. In court, they've said that the protests he led stoked anti-Semitism, that his presence would undermine Middle East peace efforts, but he hasn't been charged with a crime. What's at stake in this case?
What's at stake is free speech. Mr. Mahdawi did nothing but advocate on behalf of his people. He was born in a refugee camp in Palestine, came here to study peace and to advocate peace, but called for the recognition of Palestinian human rights. One of the bedrocks of this country is supposed to be the freedom to speak up. And if courts don't see that, or if we can't uphold the Constitution in this way, then we all need to take a deep, hard look at ourselves and our Constitution.
And what do you say to those accusations that he stoked anti-Semitism, that his presence would undermine Middle East peace efforts?
I find it laughable because this man only advocates for peace. And so if unless the compromise to foreign policy is peace, I'm not sure what their claim really is.
Can your client just be rearrested on the same grounds since the Secretary of State is invoking this act?
Not under the Secretary of State's provision. Again, he cannot be rearrested on the basis and the grounds that the government has attempted to in the present case.
Would you say this is a precedent-setting case?
Yes, I think it is. And I think the judge saw 130 people wrote declarations attesting to this man's character, who he is, and what he advocates for. And I think that this case speaks to all of our understanding of this country, which is that we have the right to speak and we have the right to advocate on behalf of Palestinian human rights.
Luna Droubi is one of the lawyers for Mohsen Mahdawi, who was released on Wednesday by a federal court in Vermont. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Israel has attacked Syrian government forces near Damascus in what it says is a bid to protect a religious minority. The Israeli airstrike and recent clashes between Druze and Sunni Muslim fighters have so far killed dozens this week. NPR's Jane Arraf has more on the latest threat to Syria's stability.
The Druze are one of Syria's biggest minorities. The community is an offshoot of Shia Islam that has long been marginalized and persecuted. Their militias control one of Syria's southern provinces and some towns and cities near Damascus. Since the Assad regime fell last year, there have been isolated clashes with government security forces, who are mostly from a militant Sunni Arab group. But tension had eased until this week. A voice recording claiming to be a Druze insulting the Prophet Muhammad was widely circulated on regional media, like the censored version from a Lebanese outlet. It set off clashes Tuesday in the Damascus suburb of Jarmana. Syrian government officials said 14 people, Druze and government security forces, were killed. Druze officials themselves condemned the recording. But the clashes spread yesterday to the town of Ashrafiyat Sanaya, close to Damascus. And then Israel stepped in. State media said all in all, in Wednesday's clashes, 16 security force members were killed. The area's governor, Amara Sheikh, said it was Israeli airstrikes that killed at least one Syrian government fighter and a town resident. Israel called the attack a warning and said it had struck an extremist group. Israel had threatened earlier this year to launch attacks in Jarmana to protect the Druze. In Israel, Druze men serve in the Israeli military. The Syrian government and its main backer, Turkey, consider increasing Israeli attacks and incursions into Syria as a threat to the new government's sovereignty and stability. Turkey's president called the Israeli strikes unacceptable. Syrian Druze are split over the issue of Israeli protection, although most reject it. Syrian state media said government forces reached an agreement with Druze elders after the clashes, and this morning there's an uneasy truce. Jane Arraf, NPR News, Amman.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, Terry Gross pays tribute to her late husband, Grammy Award-winning jazz critic Francis Davis, who died on April 14th. Terry is going to talk about him, read excerpts of his award-winning writing, and play some of the music he wrote about. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio, and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Former Vice President Kamala Harris has gone public with a pointed critique of President Trump's first 100 days in office. As KQED's Scott Schaefer reports, it comes as Harris is considering a run for governor of California.
Harris spoke at a dinner last night marking the 20th anniversary of Emerge America, which helps elect Democratic women. It was her first major speech since leaving office in January, and the former vice president didn't mince words about the administration that followed hers and Joe Biden's.
Instead of an administration working to advance America's highest ideals, we are witnessing the wholesale abandonment of those ideals.
Harris said unless Congress and the courts stand up to Trump, the nation will face a constitutional crisis.
They are counting on the notion that if they make some people afraid, it will have a chilling effect on others. But what they're overlooking, what they have overlooked, is that fear is not the only thing that's contagious. Courage is contagious.
She called on Americans to unite against attacks on judges and the courts while supporting due process and equal justice for everyone, including immigrants. Harris, who was a U.S. senator from California when Biden picked her to run for vice president, is mulling over a run for California governor next year when Governor Gavin Newsom's term ends. She made no mention of her own political future during the speech. The race has already attracted a slew of well-known Democrats, including former Congresswoman Katie Porter and former Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra, who says he's staying in the race no matter who gets in. Lieutenant Governor Eleni Kounalakis is hoping to become the state's first female governor, but would likely shift to another statewide office if Harris gets in. For NPR News, I'm Scott Schaefer in San Francisco.
For many Vietnamese Americans, this week's ceremonies marking 50 years since the fall of Saigon recall both the loss of their homeland and their struggles to make a new life in America. Erin Fung Steinhauer remembers her mother, who had to send some of her 12 children off alone on tiny rickety boats.
Whether you're taken by Thai pirates, they kill you, or they take you to prostitution, or you get drowned in the sea, or you starve to death. My mother had to make the difficult decision to allow her children to leave even without her.
Steinhauer was 9 when she made it to the U.S. Her mother eventually made it to America, too. Steinhauer founded the D.C.-based nonprofit Vietnam Society, which promotes Vietnamese arts and culture. And she reminisced with me yesterday and spoke of unresolved impacts from the Agent Orange defoliants that still pollute Vietnamese soil to the very human trauma suffered on both sides of the Pacific.
So I feel like I lost twice, in a sense. Right after the war, loss was replaced by fear of persecution when everything is taken away and you're labeled as a traitor. And then when we came to America, just feeling lost in this country, I, as a kid, was told that we've escaped, we're here with freedom, and that I should just move on.
What was it like coming to the country that waged the war that destroyed your country at that time?
It's incredible how history can be told from different perspectives. Here in America, the story was told from the point of view that the communists kicked everybody out. The communists were the people who caused all of these problems. And even as I go through school in America, that's what I was taught. I believed that this country saved us, saved me. It wasn't until later when I searched for the truth that I knew that we were lied to for many, many years. Not just us, but even the American veterans who fought in the war. The legacies of war still persist to this day.
On the 50th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, so often it's marked with analysis of foreign policy failures, of domestic policy failures, of looking back at what happened on that day. Does it address the pain that was caused, the lives that were ripped apart, stories like your family's story?
I think it addresses some of that, but largely the suffering and the consequences of war have not been addressed sufficiently. The fact that people are still traumatized, PTSD among American veterans, trauma still affects the Vietnamese American community, high rates of suicide, high mental illness issues, and things are still not made right. The path to healing is that both governments and people need to take action, more action. Ancient Orange, it's still impacting people today, and even the bombs that were dropped in Vietnam, there are still over 800,000 unexploded ordnances all around the country still blowing up people today. Yes.
If we were having this conversation in 50 years from now, marking the 100th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, what would you want to be different?
I believe the path forward requires everyone to take responsibility. But my biggest dream is really for the younger generation who really don't know Vietnam, who many of them don't even speak Vietnamese. 40% of Vietnamese living in America was born in America. So losing your identity and a part of yourself prevents you from healing. And I wish 50 years from now that we can all find a pathway forward so that our young generations can be free of this burden of war.
Aaron Phung Steinhauer, president and founder of the Vietnam Society. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is NPR News.
Alabama now has two black members of Congress out of its 7 seats in the House of Representatives.
It's about fair representation. It's about just making sure you have someone that cares about your community.
I'm Juana Summers. Black voters there are embracing the progress, even as the Trump administration is pulling back federal diversity initiatives. More on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. is expected to gain access to Ukraine's critical minerals and other natural resources under a landmark deal that was several tense months in the making. Former ambassador to Ukraine William Taylor says both sides win.
It's fair and balanced on both sides, the American and Ukrainian. Both sides are pleased with it, are satisfied, and both sides will benefit.
The agreement does not mandate Ukraine pay back the U.S. aid it's received in its defense against Russia, even though President Trump had previously framed it as reimbursement. Ford's thanking President Trump for easing some of his 25% tariffs on autos and auto parts. CEO Jim Farley noted, though, the relief is a bigger help to competitors.
We make 80% in the U.S., so it's not, you know, it's not a significant deal for us than maybe some of our domestic competitors that import a lot, and certainly our import competitors.
Farley says the relief could lead to more jobs and higher production this summer. Today, Ford introduced its new Expedition SUV at an event in Louisville, Kentucky. The federal cost-cutting entity DOGE still drives this year's layoffs. The outplacement firm Challenger Gray & Christmas reports cuts are at pandemic-era highs. However, the firm says April saw more than 100,000 jobs eliminated compared to more than 275,000 the month before, marking a 62% decline. From Washington, this is NPR News. May Day rallies in defense of workers' rights and social justice are being held around the world. Reuters capturing big crowds marching through the French capital, among other major cities around the globe where demonstrations are happening. The ceasefire in Myanmar is formally over. The country's military rulers had called for a halt in fighting after the massive March 28th earthquake. Michael Sullivan has the latest from neighboring Thailand.
Many groups battling the military announced their own ceasefires immediately after the quake, and the military eventually responded with its own. But it was a ceasefire in name only. Independent monitors say the military continued airstrikes and other attacks against opposition positions. The ceasefire officially expired on Wednesday at midnight, even as aid groups warned that recovery efforts following the magnitude 7.7 quake in the center of the country were moving slowly, with millions of people affected. Some groups have accused the military of delaying the delivery of aid to hard-hit areas in rebel-controlled areas. The official death count from the quake has risen to roughly 3,800 people, but many observers say the real toll is far higher. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai.
U.S. stocks are trading higher this hour. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 363 points, or roughly 0.75%. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadil. The House of Representatives is striking a blow against California in a fight over electric vehicles. This morning, lawmakers voted to bar a federal waiver that allows California to impose tougher air pollution rules for passenger cars. They had already revoked two similar waivers for trucks. The fight will affect more states than just California. We've got NPR's Camila Domonoske here to explain what this is all about. Good morning, Camila.
Good morning, Leila.
So what's at the heart of this debate?
It's all about California's ability to set rules for vehicle emissions that are tougher than federal standards. One California rule requires companies to sell more zero-emission trucks, like delivery vans and tractor trailers. Another sets strict emission standards for remaining new diesel trucks. And the third one, the one the House just voted on today, requires more passenger vehicles, like cars, pickups, and SUVs, to be electric. By 2035, they'd all have to be zero-emission. California is the only state that can set its own rules like this, but other states can choose to follow California, and about a dozen have for those zero-emission passenger vehicle rules. So these rules have a big impact, and there's a national debate over them. I'll give you a little taste of it. Here's House Republican John James of Michigan, home to the Detroit automakers.
It's a Green New Deal mandate that will crush our trucking industry and drive costs up on everything. Those are facts.
And House Democrat Kevin Mullen of California.
We have a moral duty to protect our residents from unnecessary toxic air pollution and environmental harm.
And that environmental harm includes climate change. Supporters call these rules ambitious, and critics call them unrealistic.
Why is California the only state that can set its own rules?
Yeah, it's interesting. It was actually regulating air quality well before the federal government got in the game. Think of Los Angeles's infamously bad smog, right? Mm-hmm. And because of that history, California gets this special status. However, it does have to get a waiver from the Environmental Protection Agency every time it establishes its own rule, saying, yes, this rule is reasonable. And that's what this fight is about right now. The Biden EPA gave the state these waivers, and the House is trying to take them back.
But can they take them back? I mean, this is between California and the EPA. Why is Congress stepping in?
Yeah, so they're using something called the Congressional Review Act, which lets Congress reverse some agency rules within a narrow range of time. And it's an excellent question whether they can do it. It's a very hotly debated question. Both the Government Accountability Office and the Senate Parliamentarian, which are two sorts of referees within the federal government, they say that the CRA can be used to undo some things, but not these kinds of things, not these waivers specifically. And this was a huge part of the debate in the House yesterday, not just whether Congress should do this, but whether it even can.
Okay, so what happens next?
After this, the Senate needs to vote before any waiver would actually get revoked. And remember, the Senate parliamentarian says Congress can't do this. Her recommendations are technically non-binding, but it would be a big deal, a norm-busting, rules-out-the-window big deal if the Senate ignores her. The traditional auto industry and the oil industry have been pushing hard for these rules to be overturned. Green groups and health groups have defended them. And I'll note that whatever Congress does, this is still going to be a debate, whether that's in the EPA, in state-by-state lobbying, or in court.
That's NPR's Camila Domonoske. Thank you, Camila.
Thank you.
Officials from both Japan and South Korea are in Washington, D.C. this week for trade negotiations. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Seoul on how South Korea, an Asian ally and export powerhouse, is coping with tariffs.
A machine cuts rolled sheets of aluminum into 2-inch strips. The GJ Aluminum Company in Hwasong City, just south of Seoul, exports these products for use in air conditioners, electric transformers, and other equipment. GJ's CEO, Yu Kyun-yeon, says that the Trump administration's 25% tariffs on all aluminum and steel imports hit his firm just as it was investing in a new factory to make aluminum to sell to the U.S.
We were in the process of making a deal with the U.S. for about $5 million, but this problem suddenly emerged and our clients stopped the deal. We feel quite helpless.
Yu says the tariffs mean his company's products are no longer competitively priced. South Korea's government, meanwhile, has pledged more than $254 billion to assist exporters, including help in diversifying away from the U.S. market.
I think the anxiety and the feeling of unfairness is growing among South Korean companies.
Yang Hyang-ja is a politician and former executive with Samsung. She says that South Korean companies are happy to invest in the U.S. if it offers a good business environment.
아침, 저녁이 다른
What I fear most is that Trump says one thing in the morning and another in the evening. This can cause companies to suffer greatly or run into unexpected difficulties.
Under the Biden administration's friend-shoring policy, South Korean companies invested billions of dollars in the U.S. in states including Alabama, Texas, and Georgia, making semiconductors and electric vehicles. The U.S. competes with China in these high-tech sectors, and it offered incentives to entice foreign investors and offset higher U.S. labor costs. But President Trump wants to cancel the subsidies, just as South Korean firms are gearing up for production.
So now they are in the process of building state-of-the-art facilities.
Johan Ku is a senior fellow at the nonpartisan Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C., and a former South Korean trade minister.
But then all this government support kind of disappear or radically change. Then I think they really have problem in operationalizing the manufacturing facility and make their manufacturing successful in the U.S.
Yaw says that despite South Korea's advanced technologies, its economy is far smaller than the U.S.'s, and it depends on its alliance with the U.S. for security.
I think basically Korean companies are price taker, not price setter.
So instead of protesting the new policies, he says, they must instead focus on adapting to them. Lee Sung-joo is a professor of political science and international relations at Jongang University in Seoul.
Trump 행정부의 더 큰 목적은 물론 동맹을 압박하는 것 자체가 목적이라기보다는
The bigger goal of the Trump administration is not to pressure its allies, but to figure out how to deal with China and contain it. Which countries are essential to the U.S. to achieve this goal? South Korea is one of them.
He says that where U.S. and South Korean interests dovetail, there will be economic opportunities. South Korean officials will try to reach a deal with Washington before U.S. tariffs kick back in July. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
This is NPR News.
People who fled authoritarian states for America tell NPR's Frank Langfitt that the Trump administration is starting to resemble the governments they escaped. That's next time in Here and Now.
Did you know you can access the world of public radio? The latest news, standout podcasts, captivating stories, just by speaking? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Good morning, I'm Leila Fadil. Do you ever wonder what happens when you mix hot lava and chicken?
La, 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 lava, chicken. Steve's lava chicken, yeah, Steve is hell.
You get a Billboard Hot 100 hit, Jack Black's song Steve's Lava Chicken, for a Minecraft movie, which is the actual movie name, by the way. The song is just 34 seconds long. That makes it the shortest song ever on the Billboard Hot 100. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Court interpreters are there to make sure everyone involved in legal proceedings can understand what's going on. But finding interpreters can be hard. There's a lot of demand across the country, and officials say the need is growing. Sarah Lear of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
When Remy Bashy first started as a court interpreter in Milwaukee County Circuit Court, she wore high heels to the courthouse.
Then I went to flats. Now I'm in the sneaker phase.
On a recent Friday, Bashy put those sneakers to work as she walked from hearing to hearing in the sprawling complex that houses Wisconsin's largest circuit court. As a freelance Spanish language interpreter, Bashy's services are in high demand.
I turned down almost as many jobs as I accept.
Under Wisconsin and federal laws, people with limited English proficiency have the right to a qualified interpreter when they go before a court in many circumstances. Kimberly Beyer, an attorney in Milwaukee, says that ensures everyone gets a fair shake. But Beyer's seen cases be delayed while a judge searches for a qualified interpreter. For some people, that can mean more time stuck in jail. Once, Beyer had a client who had to wait months for a resolution to his parental rights case.
It really was pretty painful having to tell him over and over, we don't have enough interpreters, so we're going to have to get a new date.
There has long been a need for more court interpreters in Wisconsin, but the demand appears to be growing. In 2023, local courts billed nearly 30% more interpreter hours compared to 5 years prior. That could be fueled in part by a rising number of immigrants who have settled in Wisconsin. Janice Palma is with the National Association of Judiciary Interpreters and Translators. She says many states are struggling to find enough court interpreters. Palma says higher pay would help alleviate the problem.
There is a demand for certain skills and certain knowledge, but that's not being compensated at the level that is being demanded.
In Milwaukee County, local officials recently agreed to increase interpreter pay from $50 to $65 an hour. In Wisconsin, the state partially reimburses counties for interpreter costs. County Board Chair Marcelia Nicholson says state lawmakers should set aside more money to help localities with those expenses.
Because Milwaukee County has competing priorities, it means that sometimes we're not able to allocate as much funding to those interpreter costs.
State lawmakers are in the midst of crafting Wisconsin's next budget, and Senate President Mary Felskowski, a Republican, told NPR in a statement she's open to hearing fiscally responsible ideas to support local courts. Being a court interpreter takes more than just being bilingual. Palma says you have to process what's being said and switch from one language to another almost simultaneously.
All of this is happening at the same time. Your brain is working overtime.
Spanish interpreters are in the highest demand, but finding people qualified to interpret in other languages can be even more of a struggle. Here in Wisconsin, Hmong is one of the most commonly spoken foreign languages. But since there are no certified Hmong interpreters in the state, courts here often rely on people who drive from Minnesota. Back in a Milwaukee County courtroom, Bashy interprets as a man is sentenced in a reckless driving case.
And I also want to offer my apologies to the court and to the community.
Then Bashy's back on her feet in the courtroom hallway, waiting to be called wherever she's needed next. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Lear in Milwaukee.
This is NPR News. Thank you. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. What do you get when you mix the plot lines of Mad Men and Sex and the City? Our next guest has some ideas. Elaine Goldsmith-Thomas is the author of Climbing in Heels, a new novel that follows the precarious path of three women secretaries at Hollywood's hottest agency in the 1980s. It just came out and it's already being developed into a TV series. It's Goldsmith-Thomas's debut novel, but she knows Hollywood. She was an agency executive, studio partner, and producer, and she started, like her characters in this book, as a secretary. And she joins me now. Elaine, welcome.
Thanks, Layla.
So this book is a ride. There's backstabbing, illicit affairs, men using their power to take advantage of women. And there was this one line about the three main characters that stood out to me. They were women trying to rewrite a rule book for a place that didn't recognize them as players. Elaine, if you could just describe these three women at the heart of the novel and what they're navigating.
You know, I like to think of it as a story of friendship, of survival, yeah, of betrayal, of standing up when they walk by, of saying, I won't quit when they want you gone. But it's also the story about how some of those women inadvertently become very much like the monsters they worked for. And I try not to judge these characters. It was the terrain in front of them. It was the mountain in front of them, and they wanted to break through. And all three of them had a few things in common, but yeah. Beanie especially will not take no. No just means try again, and yes means love.
And Beanie is the character that really wants to be an agent. She's going to find a way in, even though every answer is no, women don't get to be agents.
It's the sliver of hope that she hangs on to. It's the idea that if you try right, if you do it again, if you can make them see you, you can show them how smart you are, even if you don't look the part. And in the 80s, there wasn't a girls' club.
Let's talk about that, because you broke in the 80s, and you started as a secretary, yeah, right, at the William Morris Agency?
Oh, yeah.
So is this how it was for women then? Because in your book, the male agents refer to secretaries as sexitaries, and God forbid they get a secretary with a degree and ambition. They're just looking for women they're attracted to.
Well, you weren't allowed. First of all, not all of them were like this. And mm-hmm. some of this is, most of it is completely made up, but some of it isn't. You realize that people like Harvey Weinstein were not the exception. They were the rule.
Wow.
While they would get their hands slapped sometimes, the bad boys, they were secretly celebrated by the boys on the first floor who had their days in the 60s when they were the raucous young bucks. So again, it's fictional, but some of it isn't.
So how did you break in? I mean, you ended up with this incredible career working with Julia Roberts, Jennifer Lopez, Nicolas Cage, yeah, so many others.
First of all, I would say that I stood on the shoulders of some remarkable women. And I had a rather abusive boss, and it was difficult at times. And I was able to survive it barely, but it was difficult and ingrained in my memory. But the more they said no, the more I wanted it. I knew I would be a good agent.
You know, your novel is described as sexy and smart and entertaining, and it is all of those things, but it's hard to read in moments, reading the way women are contorting themselves to be what a man wants, to try to have the things she wants in life, which is in places what these women are doing. How did you navigate writing about this darker side of Hollywood, including sexual assault, and know that sort of whisper network everybody knows and men are celebrated for?
I decided to tell the truth. And I could only have the truth through my experiences, right? I decided to tell it.
Yeah.
Do I have time to tell you my Bill Cosby story?
Yes, tell me your Bill Cosby story. I was going to ask about that.
So Mr. Cosby was giving a luncheon for the secretaries at William Morris. Very nice of him, because his show was such a success and I was invited. And again, when you're a secretary, you just say you want to be a secretary, because if personnel finds out, oops, you can lose your job, or so I believed. So I was there and he came up to me and, you know, I had a name tag. He goes, Elaine, tell me about you. Where did you go to college? And I said, Berkeley and UC Santa Barbara. Wow. What do you want to do with your life? I said, I want to be a secretary. Really? You went to those two universities. You want to be a secretary? Come on. What do you want to do?
And I said, you want to know what I want to do? He said, yeah. I said, I want to be an agent. I want to be the best agent that ever lived, and I want to represent you someday. And I want you to say she was the best there ever was. And he laughed out loud. And then he left, and later on, I got a call from one of the executive secretaries on the first floor who said to me, Mr. Cosby has some contracts and has asked that you come to his hotel room and wait for him to sign them.
No way.
And I was so excited. I was like, yes. And I went to the bathroom and I was fluffing my hair or whatever. And the secretary to the president of the agency walked in and said, don't do it.
Wow.
Now, she didn't say anything untoward would happen. She just said, you want to be an agent. And anybody else who's ever done anything with him or for him, they always end up, you know, he helps them get other jobs, I think she said.
And knowing what we know now, though.
Right. But she scared me. And she scared me enough that I just didn't do it and regretted it forever until I realized I would have been the person who said, yeah, I'll have another Kool-Aid. You know, yeah. I would have been, because I felt so seen by him.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Which is so much of what's in your book, and you do so well in this book, seeing the way that these power dynamics are abused. And the way that people have to navigate them also abuse them back. Like, okay, if this is what I have to do, let me figure out how to create the rule book that works for me.
Yeah, the strategy, because it is strategy. The people behind the people are the ones that hold their legacies and their secrets. And this is a book about the people behind the people.
And the secrets.
And the secrets.
That was Elaine Goldsmith Thomas, author of the novel Climbing in Heels. More than 60 women have accused Bill Cosby of sexual assault. In 2018, he was found guilty of drugging and sexually assaulting a woman at his home, citing a violation of his due process rights. That conviction was overturned in 2021. Cosby has maintained his innocence. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin.